This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Greta Gerwig has just made her directing debut. She previously co-wrote and starred in the films Frances Ha and Mistress America, which were co-written and directed by her partner Noah Baumbach. She also co-starred in 20th Century Women, Greenberg, and Jackie. Her new movie, Lady Bird, which she wrote and directed, draws on some of her own experiences when she was making the transition out of high school, preparing to leave home and start college. The movie centers on a complex mother-daughter relationship, a relationship that becomes particularly fraught when the teenage daughter is trying to assert her identity as a soon-to-be adult. This will be recognizable territory for a lot of mothers and daughters. Saoirse Ronan plays Christine, a senior at a Catholic high school in Sacramento. One of the ways she's asserting her independence is by renaming herself Lady Bird and insisting that her mother call her by that name. The movie opens with Lady Bird and her mother, played by Laurie Metcalf, alone in the car, coming back from checking out local colleges. The mother is driving. They've been listening to the conclusion of the audiobook of Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, which leaves them both in tears. But they're soon arguing about where Lady Bird wants to go to college.
I want to go where culture is,
but
like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or
a
at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire,
well,
where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice
the way
enough.
That you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like
Christine.
You said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College, and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Greta Gerwig, welcome to Fresh Air, and I should explain. Do you want to explain what just happened when the mother is screaming?
Oh yes. What just happened is the actress Saoirse Ronan playing Christine Lady Bird McPherson. She just jumps out of the car, out of the moving car.
So this is the daughter. The daughter's just like she's so angry with her mother. She just jumps out of the car.
That's right.
And it's the only like totally crazy unhinged thing that she does during the movie. Why did you want her character to start by doing something so extreme?
Well, I think everybody knows what it feels like to be in a car, particularly with your mother and or with your daughter, and either you want to shove them out of the car or you want to jump out of the car. There's a quality to fighting in cars where you're trapped, and it felt like it kind of gave the right tone for the movie, and it's going for something that's emotionally real. And then the entire scene, to me, it starts off with them listening to John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath on book on tape that they checked out from the public library, and they're having this moment where they're both crying at the end of the book, and they're really connecting. And then within 2 minutes, it's completely off the rails.
Why did you want a mother-daughter relationship to be so central in your directorial debut?
Well, I feel that it's such a rich relationship. It has a tremendous amount of love and a tremendous amount of angst. And I don't know any woman who has a simple relationship with their mother or with their daughter. And I feel that it's not something that's given as much cinematic time as it is worthy of it. So I wanted to give it a space that you would usually reserve for a romantic relationship, that it kind of follows these ups and downs and these fights and also these moments of real connection. And I knew I wanted to set something that in Sacramento, California, which is my hometown, which I love very much. And I knew that I wanted to make something about a mother and a daughter, but I didn't know what it was going to exactly end up being, but I did have a hunch, and I had a hunch that the mother-daughter dynamic was something that would be infinitely interesting and also would feel both like the oldest story and new somehow.
You said that you're interested in how women fight.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think women fight differently than men when it comes to an argument?
I do. You know, I never really thought about it as being different until I had the script for the film, and I was going around and I was talking to different financiers about putting money into the film and making it, and most of those people are men, And if they were raised with sisters or if they had daughters, they knew what it was. They said, oh yes, that's my mother, my sister, that's my wife and my daughter. But if they didn't, they had no idea that that was how women fought and how they loved too. I think it was kind of like they were getting to look into a world that they didn't know existed.
So the title of your film, Lady Bird, is the name that the main character, the daughter, gives herself. Her real name, name is Christine, but she wants to be called Lady Bird. She wants her school to call her Lady Bird. She wants her mother to call her Lady Bird. And it seems like there's something so passive-aggressive of insisting that your mother, who named you Christine, should now have to call you by a totally different name, Lady Bird.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a rejection of everything her mother gave her, including her hair color. It's just totally like, I'm not yours.
But the funny thing is, for me, when I knew that you were, before I knew anything about the film, when I knew that your forthcoming film was going to be called Lady Bird, I thought, LBJ's wife?
I know.
Because to me, like, Lady Bird means, like, you know, the former first lady. Did you think about that when you named it Lady Bird?
No, although I will say I just did press in Texas, and it's so confusing there. They were like, why? Why did you call it Lady Bird? You know, the truth is, I mean, this is one of the things that's so mysterious about writing, and it takes me a very long time to write. It takes me a long time to finish scripts partly because I don't do any improvisation once I'm on set, and I like having the document have integrity on its own. But that being said, there's a fair amount of writing for me which feels unconscious, and I almost feel like I don't know where it's coming from, and I do actually experience characters speaking to me or through me, and I don't know where that comes from. But Lady Bird, the name Lady Bird, was something that came out of, I had been writing all these other scenes, and I couldn't find exactly how it all fit together. I felt like I kept hitting a wall, and then I put everything aside, and I wrote at the top of the page, why won't you call me Lady Bird? You promised that you would. And I have no idea where it came from. And I looked at it and I thought, what's this? And who is this person who makes someone call her that? And then I kept pressing on it and I found this character behind it. I didn't make anyone call me by a different name, so it's not coming from me. But then I remembered later, and this is the creepy, mysterious part of writing, there's a Mother Goose nursery rhyme, Lady Bird, fly away home. And then it finished, it says, your house is on fire and your children are gone, which is depressing. But I think that that had lodged itself somewhere in my brain. But the truth is, I find writing to be a process of, my unconscious knows a lot more than I do, and then I try to trust it as much as I can and consciously craft it into something that has story and propulsion, but trusting that underneath it there's something at work that I don't have control over.
So in this mother and daughter story that you've written, the daughter rejects the name her mother gave her. Her mother gave her the name Christine. And she says, no, you have to call me Lady Bird now. That's my name.
Right.
But the name you gave the character, Christine, if I'm not mistaken, is the name of your actual mother.
It is.
Was it also a way, naming the daughter Christine, was it also a way of kind of telegraphing to your mother, I'm not angry with you. This movie is not trying to make you into a monster.
Maybe. You know, it's funny. I think I always like the name Christine, too, because it's a religious name.
Because it has Christ in it.
It's Christ. It's the female version of Christ. And I spent a lot of time thinking about saints, lives of saints. And I read documents of lives of saints and how I was always interested in who they were as people and that they both were these people who were divinely inspired, but they were also kind of just annoying teenagers. Like the story of Saint Ignatius, who started the Jesuits, he has a saint story of he was a military man, and he was he was a soldier and he wanted to be a great soldier and a hero, and he was very ambitious. And but he hurt his leg, and while he was recuperating, he was reading The Lives of the Saints, and he had this kind of teenage ambition moment of he basically looked at it and said, I could do that. I can do that better than those saints. I could be the best saint there ever was. And he set out in almost this childish way to do it. And sort of the story as I've read it was that the moral of it, in a way, is that God can use whatever you have, even if it looks unpromising, even if you're just a kind of an arrogant teenager, that can be something that's transformed into something holy. And so I think giving her a name like Christine, it kind of drew that connection. And it's not something I need the audience to know while they're watching it, but I think for me it becomes an organizing principle.
What was your saint name when you were given one?
You know, I'm not Catholic. I was not
You're
raised
not Catholic?
Catholic.
Oh, I assumed you were Catholic. No. There's so much Catholicism in the movie. She goes to a Catholic school. Oh, right. I read you were raised Unitarian.
Yeah, I was raised Unitarian Universalist, but I did go to a Catholic high school, and I've always been drawn to Catholicism, and I'm very admiring of many parts of it. My sister is too. She studied with the Jesuits at the Berkeley Theological Union, and she never converted, but she got her master's in divinity, and we both separately have always been fascinated by it. And then when I was in high school, and I sang in the choir. I was second soprano, so I was not singing the main line, but I always really liked being part of it, and I liked the ritual, and I liked I knew a lot of really interesting priests and nuns, and I think, you know, I am interested in faith and tradition and how it functions and how it informs people's lives, and it's something I've been serious about without ever being a Catholic.
So when you went to Catholic school in mm-hmm. high school, and mm-hmm. you were not Catholic, did you feel like you were more Catholic than a lot of the Catholic kids in the school because you were actually interested in the rituals and in the saints?
Yeah. Well, I think because it wasn't my background, I was allowed to love it in a way that if maybe it had been, you would seek to reject it.
Because it couldn't oppress you because it had no power over you. You could just take what was
exactly
beautiful from it.
That's right. And I didn't have to feel like it was something I had to define myself against. It could mm-hmm. be something that just was enriching. But I think I also think Unitarian Universalism, which my dad always describes as we believe in at most one God, I think this is the right word, ecumenical. Is that what I think it means?
Yes.
All the different it has a sense of really instilling a reverence for other religions that I think can be a way in to a tradition that's not yours.
So there's a scene where they're shopping together for her prom dress. And shopping is such a thing for mothers and daughters. Like, you're together mm-hmm. doing an activity. It can be a real bonding experience, except that your taste can really be different. And when your mother really likes something and she's paying for it because you're not earning a salary yet and you really hate it,
yes,
or vice versa, it's like such trouble, and like all these other issues can come up as a result. So let's hear this shopping scene. And so they're shopping for the prom dress, and Lady Bird is coming out of the dressing room that her mother's waiting outside of in this like pink dress, like below the knee dress, that's very, it's a little princessy, I'd say, mm-hmm. and very pink. And here's the conversation they're having about it.
I love it.
Is it too pink? What?
Do
Why can't you say I look nice?
I thought you didn't even care what I think.
I still want you to think I look good.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was telling you the truth. You want me to lie?
No, I mean, I wish that you liked me.
Of course I love you.
But do you like me?
I want you to be the very best version of yourself that you can be.
What if this is the best version?
That's Laurie Metcalf and Saoirse Ronan from Lady Bird. Why can't the mother just say, I love you and I like you?
Well, I think she's terrified that if she says, you're good just as you are, that she won't continue to grow. And I think immediately after she says it, the in the film, Saoirse closes the door and Laurie has this look like she's going to knock and say something and then decides not to. And to me, I think, you know, it's a heartbreaking scene because they're missing each other. And her mother can't concede the point because she's too scared. And I'm always interested in how people use language to not say what they mean. And I think in so many of the fights with Lady Bird and her mother, what her mother wants to say is, I'm terrified. And she can't say it because it feels too vulnerable or, you know, for the myriad reasons that you can't say you're scared. But she just can't do it. And I talked with Saoirse and Laurie about this a lot, that I wanted the audience to feel like I know exactly where that mother is and I know exactly where that daughter is, and that you don't feel that either one of them is a villain, but you do think, oh man, it's so hard to love people and to be in a family.
So it seems to me like you're in a transition in your life now, going from being like the young actress to being like the director.
Yeah,
no. To being like the director who isn't even in the new movie. It's a really new stage of your career. And the reviews that I've seen have been really good. So it's a new stage of your career that seems like the door remains open for you to continue, you know, walking through. So what's this transition feeling like to you?
Well, it's happened in stages in a way because I worked on the script for so long, and I had this script I thought was good, and then I started involving people, and I involved producers and my cinematographer and then these different actors, and I had time to prepare. I had a year to prepare with my DP and Sam Levy, who also shot Frances Ha and Mistress America, and we had a whole year to talk about it. And I'd cast Saoirse a year before we started shooting, and so this sort of stepping into the role of director, I had an adequate amount of time and space to really over prepare for that moment. And then once I was on set, and even really before I was on set, it's just the most fun I've ever had doing anything, and I loved it so much.
Really? Directing?
Oh, God, I just love it. The film is such an inherently collaborative art form, and I have never felt more happiness in my life than I have sitting next to the camera with Sam operating, listening to great actors say the words I've written, but bring them to life. And it's some combination of a complete and total control, because it's your vision and your words, and a total lack of control, which is that you give all these other people faith that they will bring their best and that they will elevate what you've done. And it's extraordinary. I absolutely love it.
So in your movie Lady Bird, the main character starts doing theater in high school. And the show that they're doing is Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along. I love that show. I love the songs from that show. And
Me
it's
too.
Interesting that you chose that show because it begins with three friends in middle age. and their lives have not worked out as they'd hoped, and they've all become like really cynical about life and about each other. Then the show goes backwards in time. As the show goes deeper and deeper into the past, the characters become less and less cynical and more idealistic and more just kind of in love with being together. And you're starting off, you know, in high school where that show kind of ends. So tell me why you chose Merrily.
Well, Merrily is my favorite musical. I've listened to the original cast recording so many times. It makes me cry instantly. I'm a big Stephen Sondheim fan in general,
and
I had written it into the script.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. I had no idea how I was going to get the rights to do it. I just loved it, and it has, again, it has that quality of time slipping away faster than you can hold on to it. Even though it's going backwards, it feels like you're always like, oh, that time's gone. Now we're in another time. And that quality was something that I wanted to capture. And I thought it would be, I never did Merrily We Roll Along in high school because it would be a completely odd show for a high school to do. Although since showing the movie to a lot of people, people have come up to me and said my high school did it, which I find totally amazing. And I just thought there's something about it to me that it has this central ache that I had hoped that my movie would have. So
about transitions?
Like, yeah, and about how where you end up and where you're from, mm-hmm. How they're connected and how they're also so different. And I felt like it answered something in that to me. And even the songs in the middle, the, you know, Yesterday Is Gone, See the Pretty Countryside, or Dreams Don't Die, So Keep an Eye on Your Dreams, because before you know where you are, there you are. That felt to me like those songs and those lyrics spoke so deeply to what I was trying to capture that it just seemed perfect to me.
And how did you get the rights for it?
Well, I was very lucky because when Scott Rudin signed on to make this film, he has produced Stephen Sondheim and he's friends with Stephen. And he said, I wrote Stephen Sondheim a letter, which Scott got to him. And he said, yes. So that was just the most exciting thing that could have happened to me mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. It's Stephen Sondheim. And I've still never met Stephen Sondheim.
Greta Gerwig, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Greta Gerwig wrote and directed the new film Lady Bird. Film critic Justin Chang has a review of Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. The film is set during the early days of World War II. Hitler's forces are rampaging across Western Europe when Churchill is appointed Prime Minister of England in 1940.
Winston Churchill is having something of a renaissance moment in popular entertainment. In the recent film Churchill, Brian Cox played the Prime Minister as he confronted the looming specter of D-Day. John Lithgow won an Emmy for his turn as an aging post-war Churchill in the hit Netflix series The Crown. Now comes Darkest Hour, a ham-fisted prestige entertainment, but a grand showpiece for Gary Oldman, who gives us perhaps the biggest, brashest, and certainly most prosthetic-heavy screen version of Churchill yet. Directed by Joe Wright from a hyper-eloquent script by Anthony McCartan, Darkest Hour unfolds over several tense weeks in May 1940. Western Europe is crumbling under Hitler's onslaught. Neville Chamberlain, having gotten nowhere with his disastrous appeasement policy, has resigned as Prime Minister, leaving Churchill the unlikely beneficiary. Although widely distrusted by the political establishment for his irascible, unpredictable streak, Churchill is rightly seen as the only one strong enough to unite all parties and lead Britain to victory. Even with the apocalypse looming, there's a bit of official pomp and tradition to get through. Churchill has a private audience with King George VI, who, as played by a terrifically restrained Ben Mendelsohn, is very good at hiding his reservations about the appointment. Kristin Scott Thomas puts a commanding spin on Winston's faithful, fiercely intelligent wife, Clementine, who turns up every so often to remind him why he's the right man for the job. He'd better be, anyway, with Britain's armed forces about to be wiped out by the Germans on the northern coast of France. If you've seen Christopher Nolan's harrowing epic, Dunkirk, which focused on the logistics of that famous evacuation, Darkest Hour provides an undeniably fascinating look behind the scenes. Much of the movie takes place not at 10 Downing Street, but in the Cabinet War Rooms, an underground bunker where Churchill pores over military maps, spars with his cabinet, and consults his young typist, Elizabeth, an audience stand-in nicely played by Lily James. Among Churchill's rivals-turned-advisors is Viscount Halifax, a Chamberlain ally played by Stephen Delane, who's bent on negotiating a peaceful surrender with Germany. But the Prime Minister, determined to seek victory at all costs, isn't having any of it.
There's nothing heroic in going down fighting if it can be avoided. Nothing even remotely patriotic in death or glory if the odds are firmly on the former. Nothing inglorious in trying to shorten a war that we are clearly losing.
Losing! Europe is still...
Europe is lost. And before our forces are wiped out completely, now is the time to negotiate in order to obtain the best conditions possible. Hitler will not insist on outrageous terms. He will know his own weaknesses. He will be reasonable.
When will the lesson be learned? When will the lesson be learned? How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased? Good God, given him mixed privileges before we learn. You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth.
As he demonstrated in films like Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, and Anna Karenina, director Joe Wright likes to infuse Tony literary material with a daring element of the theatrical. In Darkest Hour, that sense of showmanship plays out to visually arresting but sometimes garishly over-the-top effect. The cinematographer, Bruno Delbonnel, emphasizes the doomsday mood by giving nearly every actor a ghostly pallor. Wright sends the camera soaring around and around the crowded House of Commons, cranking up the spectacle a hundredfold. When Churchill rides a lift down into the bunker, the film boxes him in on all sides by impenetrable walls of blackness, literalizing the title and making clear, as if we needed reminding, just how isolated this man is. But if Churchill is an island, he is also a rousing populist hero, as demonstrated by an entirely fabricated sequence that gives the movie its schmaltziest moments. The Prime Minister, on his way to deliver a speech before Parliament, ends up riding the underground and listening to what his people have to say. Presumably this scene, with its cute child reaction shots and impromptu poetry recitations, is meant to bring a tear to your eye, but mine were too busy rolling to get that far. Oldman can be an actor of enormous subtlety, a quality that he has decidedly not brought to bear on his work here. This is a fist-pounding, jowl-twitching tour de force of acting. If Oldman's skinny frame seems an odd one on which to hang Churchill's larger-than-life proportions, spiritually his performance is of a piece with his madly energetic, live-wire turns in movies like Sid and Nancy and True Romance. And why not? When you're staring down history's greatest monster and an Oscar hangs in the balance, it's no time to play it safe.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, filmmaker Dee Reese, directed the new film Mudbound, which is adapted from the novel of the same name by Hilary Jordan. It's about two families in the segregated Mississippi Delta, just before, during, and after World War II. The African-American family are poor sharecroppers. The white family owns their own land, but they're still struggling. Each family has a member who goes off to fight in the war. The white soldier returns emotionally devastated. The black soldier returns to find that although he helped liberate Europe, back home in Mississippi, he has no rights. Here's a scene in which the returning black soldier, Ronzel, played by Jason Mitchell, is shopping in the general store. He's still in uniform, but when he leaves the store by the front door, he's confronted by a couple of white men, played by Jason Clarke and Jonathan Banks, who speaks first.
You use the back door.
Go on, son. Son, we don't want no trouble here. Go on. gone.
You know what? You're absolutely right. When we was overseas, they didn't make us use the back door. General Patton put us on the front line. Yes, sir. And you know what we did? We kicked the hell out of Hitler and them Jerrys. Are y'all at home safe and sound?
Mudbound also stars Mary J. Blige as the black soldier's mother and Carrie Mulligan as the sister-in-law of the white soldier. Mudbound premieres on Netflix and in movie theaters this Friday. Dee Reese also directed the HBO movie Bessie, based on the life of Bessie Smith. Her 2011 movie Pariah is about a 17-year-old African-American girl coming out and dealing with the resulting complications in her life. Writing about Reese's new movie, Mudbound, New York Times film critic A.O. Scott described it as unflinching and unsentimental in its dissection of white supremacy. Dee Reese, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, some of the story is about the kind of overt racism in Mississippi during and after the war, World War II. There's some really horrible things that happen in the film without giving anything away. Did this film have a different meaning for you after Charlottesville? The film was probably completed by then. But, you know, the March in Charlottesville, like, that's the kind of, like, overt racism that people had, you know, more or less stopped expressing in marches, and big marches. And to see that was really just, like, shocking and horrifying to so many Americans.
Yeah, I think Charlottesville was shocking for some, but it wasn't for me or for my family. I mean, because I grew up in 1980s Nashville. I grew up next to a Klan member. Like, everyone knew he was a Klan member. My dad was a cop, you know, and I grew up three houses down from people who used Confederate flags as curtains. I remember one summer I played, like, with the granddaughter of this known Klan member. Like, all summer we caught cicadas. And we had grown close, and so it was, like, time for a birthday party. And I said, oh, like, what time do I come for your party? And she's like, oh, no, you can't come to my house because my parents don't like black people. So it was this thing where, you know, even though we're two kids playing all along, like, still, like, this thing is, like, stated and, like, stated, like, without a blink. And later that night, she came by with a piece of her birthday cake. I remember to the back door, my mom was like, you can keep your cake. So for me, these attitudes, these beliefs aren't something that ever died down or ever went away or weren't visible. You know, I grew up being called nigger. Like, this is not new. And so I think the surprise kind of reveals the depths to which we've deluded ourselves, you know, and the depths to which we've kind of, like, denied kind of who we are as a country.
So when you have a friend growing up whose father is a member of the Klan, is that something...
Grandfather,
you, yeah. Grandfather. Is that something you can talk about with her? Or was that something that was, like, off, you know, like, you could not actually bring that up and discuss it?
Well, I would just say, like, oh, well, why can't I, you know, so in terms of our play, like, she would always come to my backyard and play. So she could come to my house to play, but never inside, like, only in the yard. But I could never go even to her yard to play. And so it was, like, a known thing. And it was just kind of like, you know, my parents don't like black people, said with, like, a straight face and with this kind of matter-of-factness. And so that's something that I think kind of sits with you and is one of the things that struck me in this story about this friendship. Because for the longest time, I questioned friendship and what was possible and whether or not, like, you could be friends with someone who is white and that they would really be your friend, you know, throughout, you know, everything. Or they'd be friends in school where you'd play in school, but if you saw them at the grocery store with their parents, they'd pretend like not to know you. And so, like, that was real. And so those kind of things, I think, sink into your psyche and kind of, like, draw these very real lines in, like, interactions and in relationships. And, you know, even when, like, no one's calling you a name, like these experiences are the evidence.
So you're directing this movie that's set in the Mississippi Delta, but you grew up in, I think, a suburb of Nashville. You've lived for many years in Brooklyn. So, you know, you're a city and suburb person largely, but now you really had to immerse yourself in country life to understand the characters and the setting of the film. There's a scene that's a voiceover about the violence of day-to-day country life. And the Carrie Mulligan character is stuck on this, like, dirt farm, and she used to live in a city, and she doesn't really want to be on this farm, but that's where her husband insisted on moving the family. And she's reflecting on the violence of country life, and this happens just after, in the African-American family, the father has had to shoot the mule because the mule is dying and is lame and can't you know, it's the humane thing to do.
Violence is part and parcel of country life. You've forever been assailed by dead things. Dead mice, dead rabbits, dead possums. You find them in the yard. You smell them rotten under the house. And then there are the creatures you kill for food. Chickens, hogs, deer, frogs, squirrels, pluck, skin, disembowel, debone, fry. Eat, start again, kill. I learned how to stitch up a bleeding wound, load and fire a shotgun, reach into the womb of a heaving sow to deliver a breech piglet. My hands did these things, but I was never easy in my mind.
So, Dee Reese, what did you have to do to get on that mindset of that kind of violence of country life?
Yeah, so this passage was one of my favorite from Hillary's book because it sets such a tone for the world, as you mentioned, like the easiness of death. It's just like a speed of life. Like, I want the characters and the world to move at the speed of life. And I'm looking at the indifference of nature where, you know, it seems that nature's working against them, but in fact, it's just that nature is indifferent to them.
I know one of your grandmothers, or maybe it was your great-grandmother, kept a journal. Tell me who it was, and also if you were able to use anything from there to help you understand the characters you were writing about and the era you were writing about.
Absolutely. So my grandmother's name is Ernestine Smith. She was born in 1925 in Faraday, Louisiana. And she wrote this journal or this unpublished book about, you know, her life growing up. And so she wrote about her parents picking cotton, my great-grandmother, Fami. And so she would tell me stories about how she and her little brother, Clarence, would ride on her mother's cotton sack and how she herself, you know, vowed she would never pick cotton. She didn't want to chop cotton. She wouldn't work as a domestic worker. She wanted to be a stenographer. And so that's something I absolutely put in the film visually and intellectually, you know, this shot of this little girl and this little boy kind of riding backwards on a cotton sack. And also the character Lily Mae, Florence's daughter, I made her want to be a stenographer, whereas in the book she's a singer and she can sing. You know, I injected my kind of grandmother's history and transposed that onto her because it gives this little girl a different kind of interest.
And one of the characters says to her, black people don't become stenographers.
Yeah, and then the father affirms her and says, well, you'll be the first, you know, and I feel like that was an attitude that was, you know, mm-hmm. that pervaded, like, in my family. It was, like, not about the thing that you could see necessarily, the idea that you could be something that you couldn't even see was, like, a huge one.
So with your grandmother, like, her grandparents would have been slaves, right?
Exactly, yes, and there's pictures of them. So I have this picture of them, Emma and Bill, and the photograph I have of them is actually taken from a larger photo of a plantation of, like, a group of slaves. So every family stood in their family group and had this picture, and then everyone cut out the square that had their members in it. So the picture I have of them is like an excerpt from a larger picture. So it's just a square with just their faces in it.
Not everybody has photographs or writing or anything that dates back that far. You know, like several generations back. What does it mean to you to have that evidence of your family's past?
It's invaluable to have it. Like, my grandmother's a very meticulous, you know, organized person, you know, and the fact that she, you know, even, you know, took the time to sit down and, like, not just write, but, like, type out her experiences. There's, like, anecdotes about going to the market truck or anecdotes about funerals or people being sick. And, like, there's some pages that's, like, they're, like, biblical. It's, like, you know, it's, like, these begats or who had who and, you know, how they looked. And she gives, like, physical descriptions and demeanors. And it's amazing to have it. And it gives me a sense of connectedness. And it's amazing to look at the pages. It's one thing to hear a voice. It's one thing to have the story. And it's another thing to have the actual, like, faces kind of looking back at you. And I definitely had those and relied upon those from Mudbound and shared them with department heads. You know, it's just like a visual reference because you can see the lives in these people's faces.
So, you know, in the movie, family and home are not necessarily safe places. In the African-American family, it's not a safe place because of the location, because it's Mississippi, and because, you know, there's so much racism. There are very strict limitations in terms of what they're allowed to do. with their lives and what kind of relationships they're allowed to have, where they're allowed to go. And in the white family, the family isn't a safe place because, you know, the grandfather is really a monster. And in terms of Carey Mulligan's character, her husband, you know, he's the husband, so he's going to tell her what to do. And even though she's wiser than he is, she has to take orders from him. So, I mean, family and home are not safe. It seems to be a theme for you because in Pariah, you know, your earlier film, it's about a 17-year-old girl who's figuring out that she's a lesbian and is trying to figure out how, like, what does that mean and who is she and does she tell her parents? And if so, how does she tell them? And they're not going to be happy about it. And she's going to have to leave home to become who she is. So it seems to be a theme in your work. Was that a theme in your early life that you had to leave home to become yourself?
Yeah, I think for me, as someone growing up, you know, in like Antioch, Tennessee, I definitely felt the desire to, like, I definitely knew there wasn't elsewhere. I definitely knew that, like, if I were going to be free, I needed to be away from kind of like Nashville and kind of get out of the South and get out of the country. And even though, when I first went to schools in Florida, I just knew that I didn't want to go to college in the same place I grew up. I knew that expansiveness was necessary. Like, I think, like as a teenager, I did a program. There's like this thing called the LEAD program in business because I was going to go into business. So, and you could apply to which school you wanted to do this kind of like summer program at. And so I put down Columbia University as the place I wanted to go. And so, you know, junior high, like I had got to go to Columbia University and spend a summer there in New York City. And like I knew from that moment on, like New York City was a place where I could be. Like New York City is a place you can be yourself completely. And, you know, as long as it's authentic, like it's kind of like no questions asked. And so that's definitely something I felt like as a teenager and wanting to get away. And I don't know, I just think getting away from home is just helpful.
So you've said that when you made Pariah, your film about the 17-year-old girl who's realizing that she's a lesbian, that you were imagining what it would have been like had you come out earlier, because you were in your 20s, I think, when you came out.
Mm-hmm.
What got you thinking about that? What it would have been like had you come out when you were 17?
I think it was living in Brooklyn and seeing it, you know. So I came out. It was like my second year of film school. And so my parents were already freaked out that I'd quit my job and gone to film school. And then this double, like, you know, hit of like, and also, by the way, I love women. So I think they thought I was having a nervous breakdown and tried to have a couple of like interventions. And so for me, it was, and I remember just feeling like such guilt, you know, feeling like I'd hurt my parents, feeling like I'd like, you know, that I was like hurting them in some major way. And I was a grown person, like I wasn't living, you know, under their roof. I was paying my own bills. And so I was surprised at the magnitude of guilt like that I felt and like just fear that I was doing the wrong thing. And so, you know, meanwhile, I'm living in Brooklyn where I'm seeing teenagers who not only like know who they are, but are actively being it. And I was just kind of amazed at their bravery, like amazed that they were able to like do this, you know, in any small degree. And so I figured out, wow, you know, if I, you know, like what would it have been like if I had come out earlier?
In the movie, the mother's Christian, and that has a lot to do with why she's so upset that her daughter is a lesbian. Are your parents Christian, and did that have to do with their initial reaction to you coming out?
They are, yeah, yeah. Which for me is the other thing I wanted to explore. Like, it's not these mutual exclusive things like sexuality and spirituality, because I would identify as a Christian, and I'm also a lesbian, you know. And so for my parents, it felt like a mutually exclusive thing. Like, oh, well, you can't be Christian if you're this way, you know. So they had this very kind of like finite idea of spirituality and belief, and that didn't ring true for me. And so, like, I felt like, well, actually, like my grandmother, I remember it was like one Thanksgiving, because I had limited like my going home just to holidays. And so we're at Thanksgiving table. It's me and my mother and my grandmother. And so my grandmother, like, says the grace over the table. In her prayer, she says, "You're perfect the way you are. There's not one thing I would change about you." And my mom said, "Oh, well, there's one thing." And my grandmother said, "Nope, there's not one thing I would change about you." And, like, that moment on, I felt vindicated, like, almost cried. Like, I felt like she was telling me in that moment that she accepted me for who I am and that she loved me unconditionally. And in that same way, it's like she kind of led my mom around, like my parents have come around where they love me unconditionally. And, you know, I understand they still might, I do actually think they still struggle. I think there's like not a spirituality, but there's like a religiosity, you know, at least, that tells them that I'm somehow in the wrong, and I think they probably have moments where that bothers them. But on the whole, you know, I feel loved, and I feel like that they're dealing with their own kind of beliefs about it.
When you were 24, you changed your name from Denise to Dee.
That's not true, actually.
That's
my name
true?
Was never Denise. No, my name is DeAndrea, and I never changed it. But Dee is my screen name.
Oh, okay. Why do you prefer Dee?
Just because it's a brand, right? It's branding. So, like, Dee is what my aunties always called me growing up. So it's like a thing that's always been with me. And for the purpose of filmmaking, it's like in the middle of film school, you know, instead of DeAndre Reese on the screen, Dee Reese, it's like pithier, it's androgynous, and it's easier to handle, pick you up by. Like, I would probably get far less press coverage as DeAndre Reese than as Dee Reese. And like, when people can't pronounce something, they're less likely to engage with it. And so I feel like all my life I was teaching people how to say my name, how to say DeAndrea. And as I made the transition to being an artist, to being a filmmaker, I looked at this history of artists that changed their names. And like, my grandmother had actually changed her name from like Auberstein to Ernestine, and so I kind of took it on as something that was available to me. Like, you can name yourself. Audre Lorde took the Y off her name, so to me it seemed like a noble thing that was possible and accessible, and that I should, you know, shouldn't hesitate to do.
Dee Reese, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Dee Reese co-wrote and directed the new movie Mudbound. It's streaming on Netflix and playing in select theaters. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.